Life.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. We're also pleased to have once again here in the studio with us a visiting writer. He is here as part of a series, the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series. This is sponsored by the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program. And throughout the course of the school year, in the fall and the spring, writers and poets come here so that people can have an opportunity to hear them talk about their work and read their work. And also, of course, so students, people who are writers, can have an opportunity to meet with them and talk about the craft of writing. And we're pleased here to have with us Chris Abani. He is a novelist and poet. He was born and did a lot of his growing up in Nigeria. His first novel was published when he was just 16 years old. It was a political thriller titled Masters of the Board. Now, 2 years after that was published, this was in 1985, he was arrested and put in prison. The government said his novel posed a threat to national security because it presented a plan for a political coup. He was arrested twice more. The third time he was convicted of treason. He was actually sentenced to death. But we're glad that he is here and in one piece. He has now published a number of books. He has two novels, Masters of the Board and Graceland. That came out in 2004, and one that is scheduled to be published in February of next year, titled The Virgin of Flames. He has also published several collections of poetry, Hands Washing Water, Dog Woman, Daphne's Lot, and Calicutta Republic. He is an associate professor at the University of California, Riverside. He also teaches in the MFA program at Antioch University in Los Angeles, and he's won a number of awards and recognition for his work, and we are pleased to have him here with us. Also, he will be doing a reading. Is that today?
Reading? Yes.
He'll be doing a reading today at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That's at 809 South Wright in Champaign, 4:30 this afternoon. So anyone who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana should feel welcome and can attend. Excuse me. And also people who are listening, of course, if you'd like to call in, ask questions, you can do that, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David.
You know, I came across something, actually, I thought a comment that I was interested in having you react to. This was something that here comes from another writer. She happens to be Ugandan. She's a poet and novelist named Doreen Bangana.
Yes.
You know? And this was a little piece that she wrote apparently for the Guardian, the London, a British newspaper. And here's how she starts this piece out. She says, "Sometimes I wish my life had been more tragic." She says, "This is because my audience expects me, as an African writer, to regale them with tales of hunger, war, and catastrophe." And right. She goes on to talk about the fact that she had this artist residency in Minnesota, and she was invited to give a talk. And basically, it's about the fact that given who she is, perhaps just given the fact that she's from Africa,
right,
people expect
right
a certain kind of narrative
right
to come.
Yes.
And I've also read some interviews that you have given where you said essentially the same thing. When people hear your resume, they hear political prisoner, having been in jail, sentenced to death, people have a certain set of expectations.
Right.
And you in the same interview, you said, "Well, I don't want that to define me, to be
right
who that is." I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about that, particularly what it is that if people just hear the headline about you,
right,
what kind of person they end up, what kind of person they're expecting.
Well, it depends. When I first got here, I think like I would read in some bookstores, and the notion, I think they're expecting someone that's about 6 foot tall, very gaunt, with a very existential look, smoking rolled up cigarettes. And I'm sort of a large, healthy looking young man. I'll sort of bound into the bookstore and go, "Oh, hi, I'm Chris Abani." And they go, "You're Chris Abani?" But there is an expectation that that your whole imagination should be defined by this one moment. And the thing is that I was a writer who went to prison, so I'm not a writer because I went to prison. And so I already had a set of concerns as a writer, stylistic and thematic, that I wanted to explore. And the thing is that people want you to play this out continuously, and they want you to play it out as though you were the most noble person in the world and you have to become this bodhisattva. And I'm not really a bodhisattva. I mean, it was a very traumatic experience, and it was a devastating place to be. But you know, I still get upset when I'm in traffic, and I still have the same sort of concerns. But also that imaginatively, I think what happens, especially with the terrain of publishing, is that you're always expected to occupy the real experience. Mm-hmm. And so the imagined experience, which is often really what a writer wants to do, becomes denied to you. And then coupled with the urgency of the political situations that often sort of encapsulate African situations and contexts, there is a notion that your personal urgency should be placed up against this, and you should be producing, you should be sort of the curator of the world's humanity, which it would be a nice place to be. But then given sort of the context of where America is now and all the different views pro and against the war, then one would assume that American authors should be pressed up against that, but they're not. So it's sort of those sort of expectations that can sometimes be a little limiting.
So that, and I'm sure that that extends, it's not just about the way that people in the United States, for example, think about African writers, right. But I'm sure that people here and elsewhere, I'm sure in the UK, other places, that's, people have certain expectations of African literature.
Right.
And the same thing, the same sort of thing can happen.
Right. But it's not also, it's not just also the external context like America and Britain and Europe. It's also the internal context that one has to, because there are African writers and people on the continent who have a certain expectation of what they think African literature should deliver. There are people who think your literature should be representative, even though they decry any belief in the representational form of it. But they want you to write happy stories so that people can stop seeing famine. So that even as an African writer, particularly me being a Nigerian writer, the context often is that you're caught between the expectations of the West, the expectations of home, and then what you as a writer are struggling with your own integrity and your own craft. So that it's not just sort of the West down. It's also a problem out situation. If you were to write about, say, child abuse and stuff like this, and it's considered you're airing your dirty linen in public, and then some people think, oh, yeah, that's great, and other people think, oh, no. So I think any kind of writer is always caught in this dynamic, and I think that the only added difference is that we don't have the economic power to determine a lot of our own conversations. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
This particular interview, I thought you said something really funny, that again, about this expectation that people knowing about you, let something out of that. Political yeah. prisoner, Ryan Tarlican Rummage.
Yeah, let's see how they'll plug it that way.
Talk a little bit about Masters of the Board. Okay. As I mentioned, this was something you wrote just when you were, it's a political thriller, and you just wrote when you were a teenager. What made you want to write that kind of book?
Well, you know, I think that it's political in the context of it, but not political with intention when I wrote it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'm 16, I'm reading a lot of Robert Ludlum, Frederick Forsyth, you know, the usual thriller writers. Also being Igbo, and after the Biafran War, where the Igbos sort of there was a genocide against us programs, we weren't really allowed to be taught that in history classes within the content. So a lot of our teachers would use the Jewish Holocaust as a way to talk about the Biafran experience. So here I'm in school learning all about the Holocaust. The Holocaust meets Frederick Forsyth. So it was really the most preposterous story about neo-Nazis taking over Nigeria to set up the Fourth Reich. Completely ridiculous. Nigerian James Bond. I mean, it's a good book. It's still a good thriller, but I mean, like all thrillers, it's a little preposterous. to take over a country, you need to cripple it. And so in the book, all these strategic targets that have to be sort of blown up simultaneously to bring the country to a halt. And so that's really the impetus of it. And it was not meant in any kind of political way until General Vatsa was then accused of using the book as a blueprint for a military coup.
Mm-hmm. So that's how it is that it happened, that it took 2 years. It was 2 years after the book was published.
Yeah.
Then that was when the government looked at it and said, oh, this book and this guy is trouble.
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind, tell me about your first experience of being in prison then. So you were 18 years old?
18 years old. Well, at the time, too, people were being disappeared. You know, military trucks would pull up and we'd all watch. It became like a sport. It's really terrible to say, but... and I was in the library studying to get into university, and we all rushed to the window when this truck pulled up, and of course it came for me. The first 6 months in prison were not as bad as the subsequent times, and I say this not because there wasn't sort of the same kind of focused torture. It was more kind of random beatings and this kind of thing. But also because I was in a cell with particular older political prisoners who protected me quite strenuously, including at the time the musician Fela Kuti. And you know, you're 18, and there's something about the 18-year-old mind that cannot conceive of mortality. So it was a different experience, and then actually it enraged me and really politicized me. And so when I came out of prison was when I really became sort of a political activist. Mm. Yeah.
So you mentioned the fact that the Masters of the Board was not the intent wasn't necessarily to write something that was political, certainly not something that would have been a political critique of the government of Nigeria,
nothing like that.
Then, though, the result of having been in prison then perhaps made you into it, set you on a path that otherwise we would not have gone down.
I would not have gone down. I mean, I come from a very privileged middle-class home and had no reason to engage. It's a very difficult thing, too, when we think about Nigeria or any kind of African country, we always think about it in terms of the famine pictures from Ethiopia. But, I mean, it's no different from being a middle-class kid from the suburbs of Orange County in California who would have no reason to be politically engaged until somehow you're brought into certain kinds of contexts. So, really, that's what it was. I mean, and having sort of woken up to my own political urgency to realize that there was a whole generation of us and already engaged actively in this. It was very humbling.
Mm. So you were in prison then two times after that.
Right.
How is it that you managed that last time that you had been convicted of treason and, as right. I understand, had been sentenced to death? How did you – why are you sitting here now?
Thankfully, Nigerian prison systems is as flawed as much of the country and as corrupt. And some friends were able to raise money, essentially, to buy me out of prison. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. Mm. Yeah. That's really what happened.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Chris Avani, a Nigerian-born writer. He's now associate professor at the University of California, Riverside. He also lectures in the MFA program at Antioch University at Los Angeles. He has written several novels, a number of collections of poetry. He is here visiting the campus as part of the CAR Visiting Authors Reading Series. He'll read this afternoon. And he's also here, obviously, to meet and talk with students in the program. We're also here open to questions, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, one book, actually, when I was mentioning your books that I did not mention,
right.
is this novella,
right.
Becoming Abigail, that you have your copy in front of you. And we would like to have you read a little bit so people can hear you and hear some of this book.
Should I give a little context?
Yeah, yes, do, please.
Becoming Abigail, you know, it seems like everything I write seems to have this sort of edge of tragedy to it. But I really set up trying to explore what has become an increasing problem, which is sort of sex trafficking, mm-hmm. young women, particularly brought from Africa into Europe. And so this is a story about a young woman whose relatives bring her to London from Nigeria and try to force her into this, and she resists. But then I realized, as most writers do, that sort of a social issue does not a book make. So the more I began to explore this remarkable, and I think of her almost as a real person, remarkable young woman. Her mother dies in childbirth. She looks just like her mother. So she has no, her mother was also called Abigail. She's called Abigail. Her father begins to blur the lines. But to try and find herself, she collects stories about her mother and she begins to burn them onto her skin and tattoo them on. It sort of became more a book about how one becomes who we become. And I'm going to read a small... She's obsessed with maps mm-hmm. and Chinese poetry. Chapter 3. An even light can become dirty, falling sluggish and parchment yellow across a floor pitted by hope, walked back and forth, the slap of slipper on concrete echoing the heat, gritting its teeth on the tin roof. The sound sometimes like rain, other times like the cat stretch of metal expanding and contracting. And there was also the business of reading maps, her favorite thing, the only things she read, other than old Chinese poetry in translation. Fragments memorized came to her, mostly from Emperor Wu of Han. Dripping melancholy and loss, she couldn't get enough. The poem Autumn Wind. I am happy for a moment, and then the old sorrow comes back. I was young only a little while, and now I am growing old. She was lying face down over a large map spread out on the living room floor, studying it intently. She ran her fingers meditatively over the spine of the Himalayas while peering at the upside-down fish that was New Zealand. There was something in the way the Amazon basin curled up, all green and fresh like a new fern unfurling, that reminded her of a story she had read somewhere about a Chinese poet from a long time ago who tried to live his entire life as a poem. He was famous for the beautiful landscapes he created in low, wide-lipped terracotta pots, white sand flowing like a bleached sea floating over the loam, holding it up, sweeping up to the miniature trees that would inspire the later Japanese bonsai. Rocks lounging in the shade and little pools with the littlest fish. At least that's what she imagined. There were no pictures to go by, nothing but what her mind could conceive. But it was the story of how he made his tea that stayed with her, came flooding back as her hands roamed over the smooth green of the map. She mentally went through the process, making a love of it, measured in objects. An intricate box made from rice paper that allowed just the right amount of air through, held up by a copper handle, and inside a shallow pot with a lotus in the center. Then at dusk, the freshest tips of green tea picked and wrapped in the petals of the rare blue lotus from Egypt. The box hung from the rafters of his veranda, took in all that was night. Dawn, the box taken down, the wait for the lotus petals to unravel slowly with the sun, and a pot of hot water brought to boil. The leaves dropped in the pot of water, inhaled the gentle aroma of green tea, suffused with the longing of lotus. She liked that, was like that, wrapping herself each night in anecdotes about Abigail, her mother, collected until she was suffused with all parts of her. She rolled the map up and snapped an elastic band securely around it. Leaving it in a corner, she crossed a shaft of light from the shutters and caught a swath through the moats, leaving the room to the silence and the dirty, lazy sunlight.
It's Chris Abani reading from his novella, Becoming Abigail, and that was just published
This spring, 2006. Go buy one.
It seems that one of the things that you're particularly interested in is identity. Is who one is and how a person figures out who they are and how they become who they are.
Yeah, I think it's because identity is such a fraught word. I'm an academic too, so. But I think it's more for me the moment of becoming, and it's sort of. Because less and less, I became more and more interested in the moment of our humanity and how we become what we become in sort of that way in which sort of the photographer Diane Arbus used to think of it. And so for me, my characters become almost metaphors that allow the readers to conceive of how they are, how they become who they are. And that becoming isn't something that happens once. It's sort of a very gradual daily thing. And sometimes it has, you know, massive spikes, but for the most part, it's a very subtle process that you don't even realize sort of settles over you like a shawl, and you think, oh, wait. Mm-hmm. So really, it's that moment, but also struck against, again, for me, I think the real idea that we have to earn our humanity, you know, that we're not naturally good, that we learn to be good, and we earn that goodness, and then it becomes a precious thing in a way. So rather than engaging in the polemic moment, I like to kind of, I've taken a lesson from Jimmy Baldwin. I try to engage more in the human moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We talked earlier about the fact that people may have certain expectations knowing what your experiences have been.
Right.
And they put that on you and perhaps other African writers as well. And you're not wanting to be completely defined by that. Now, having said all that, this is a rather dark story. And Graceland is, it's not that it doesn't have humor, but it also has some very dark moments.
Yeah, but you know, I think that's more it's more a function of my personality. You know, I'm somewhat of I'm drawn to the underbelly of things. Things that are easy, that are obviously easy, don't really hold my interest. It's been explored. I think it's the underbelly, it's the intersection. And I mean, it may be dark, but it's not a pessimistic or fatalistic attraction. It's sort of the realization, I suppose, that all my work is about transformation. Becoming is transformation. Mm-hmm. And that the real moment of transformation is actually the darkest moment. In fact, that we're never more beautiful than when we're the most loathsome, because that's where the choice really occurs for us. And my work gets darker and darker in a way. It's funny. It's kind of a twisted gallows. I think that's my mother's English. So I think that's the English part. That's sort of twisted humor, a black comedy kind of thing. But I mean, The Virgin of Flames is similarly about a man who wants to be a woman and doesn't know, begins to dress up as the Virgin Mary in this sort of blackouts that he has. And I'm working on a book about Nigerian circus freaks. So it just gets darker and darker and darker.
the main character in Graceland is a young man who is an Elvis impersonator.
That's right.
And this is, we should remind people, this book is set in Nigeria. So right. He actually puts on white face makeup.
Right.
And part of the thing is he does Elvis. How did that image come to you?
Well, partly, I was really fascinated with this notion of the way global culture exports itself, particularly from America to the rest of the world through movies and music and all this stuff. But not sort of in the way, again, the easy way that is about we are rejecting this stuff, because it's never rejected. It's internalized. And so I was really fascinated by the possibilities that occur in these interactions, these frictions. But I mean, I remember looking for the metaphor and couldn't quite find it. And I was watching television. The Al Jolson story was on, and they're showing this sort of white guy putting on blackface. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if I reversed that? So there's a black kid putting on white face, which becomes sort of... But then there's also Elvis Presley, who's accused, however true or false it is, it doesn't interest me, sort of the moment of accusation is more fascinating, but that he stole his music and his dance form from African Americans. Mm-hmm. And then you have a Nigerian kid practicing the dance moves of a white guy who apparently stole them from another set of black people. It's sort of, in a way also, that I think that that race is a ridiculous notion. It's a completely invented, ridiculous way of terrorizing both whites and blacks by capital. It's nothing to do with humans hating humans. And so for me, I'm constantly trying to show the ridiculousness of this sort of invention and how we continue to sustain it on both sides, sort of notions of authenticity and notions of the idea of what can be real and what isn't real, and who's blacker than who and who's whiter than who and why we're different because we're black, and these sort of things that if you're stuck in a car, both a white guy, if you took the worst sort of racist and the worst sort of extreme ideas of sort of black nationalism, you put these two people in a car and they were stuck in the middle of a forest with very hungry animals and with a flat tire, racism goes out the window. It's fixing the tire that becomes sort of the thing. And so I'm only interested in that human moment. So it was also a way of sort of poking fun at the inventions of race, and this is how popular images like to sustain this thing. Yeah.
Let's talk with a caller here. We have someone listening in Urbana who'd like to join the conversation. We'll do that here. Line number one. Hello. Is there a caller there? Hold on. There, we got you.
You got me?
Yes.
I'm really enjoying listening to this, and I'm going to see if I can keep track of the book and go out and get a copy. But I would like to make a constructive suggestion. One of the things that I've noticed about poets, and now I was hearing it when you were reading, is a particular way of reading their writing. It's a drone. It's a monotone. And it puts me to sleep. Listening to your voice with the modulations and the excitement and the ups and downs is great. And if you could add that to your reading in an appropriate way, it wouldn't put me to sleep. Not that it did this time, because you weren't reading that long. But I really feel like taking poets in particular and shaking them by the neck and saying, come on, folks, you can put some more into your reading than what you're giving out. So that's just hopefully you'll take that as a constructive suggestion. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is there some way that it's actually something that I did want to ask, so here gives me an opportunity. Is there some way, do you think, that the fact that you are a poet and do work in that form influences the way that you write prose?
Yeah, I think it does. But I mean, that's actually a valid question, a valid comment that was raised. We talk about it all the time. We call it the poet's voice, raised in the dappled sunlight.
Yeah.
It's very true. But there's something about radio that brings it out. But my own readings tend to be a little more dramatic because I do voices, as Eliot would say. But it is true that the way in which poetry is more sort of language. I mean, poetry is the only art form whose subject is language. And so as a prose writer working within language, even though language isn't the subject of prose, then the poetry does lend a certain a way of being more malleable with language. It certainly affects. It also plays saxophone, so there is music does affect that too. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening in Champaign County. Here where we are, line two. Hello.
Hi. You and you're talking about being characterized, and you know people expect you to have a political view. And in this country, it seems that people are writers, artists are expected not to have a political view, and it's they're subject to all sorts of admonitions and caricature if they do.
Right.
So I think everyone should be in more political in some ways. And I was really struck by hearing that you were in jail with Fela Kuti. We have some Afrobeat tribute bands around here and some in Chicago. The one in Chicago actually has an African American in it too, which says a lot about the culture. But it's I feel we're getting the better half of the transfer if we're imitating Afrobeat and you invent someone who's trying to be Elvis. So
yeah, but you know, Afrobeat partly didn't form until Fela comes here and begins to play with Roy Ayers and Ginger Baker and all that stuff. So, you know, there's culture, art is a dialogue that's happened between sort of Africa and particularly America, I think, for a long time that never gets talked about. So I think it's a much more fluid process. And I'm actually, Fela would love the idea of Afrobeat imitation bands. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, he has a son carrying it on too. And that's
yes.
Good. He's caricatured a lot himself, I think, and I think he was sort of quite the player, but he came from a fairly political family. If my understanding is that I didn't know this about Roy Ayers, I'll have to try and track that down a little bit, but that's a bit of a digression. But the a point I was trying to get you to perhaps talk about a bit, if you would, is, and it's away from your writing, but his mother was assassinated for being a political politician explicitly and was thrown out of a window to be killed, I think. So he came from what you characterize as an upper-class family, probably not, but at least it seemed that he wasn't just, you know, I don't know, I maybe I'm,
right.
I'm
right.
Subject to the stereotyping that everyone is, and I appreciate your effort, and perhaps I will try with a novel, novelette, since I haven't actually tried a novel in quite a while. So,
right.
Thanks for coming, and I hope you're doing okay out in L.A. too.
Thank you. Right. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Do you want to comment further?
Fela does come from, or did come, he's sadly passed on, did come from a very aristocratic family. He's actually Wallace Schenker's cousin. So
really?
Yeah, it's an old family. His mother was one of the key players in Nigeria gaining its independence, but as with all patriarchal historical forms, she's been edited out of that to a large extent. But she wasn't killed because she was a politician. Fela had, at one point after his confrontations with the current president, Obasanjo, declared his immediate compound an independent republic from Nigeria and called it Kalakuta Republic. And then the government responded by storming the building. And they did throw his 70-year-old mother out of a window and killed her. So, yeah, it was tragic. But you know, it's a country that is, sort of when you create artificial boundaries around ethnic nations and force them into some kind of a conglomerate nation, it produces a lot of difficulty. And so we're in a way trying to work through some of those things. And so it's almost impossible to be a Nigerian without being or African in the larger context of it without being always sort of politicized. But I do think that there are lots of political American writers. I think even A Harlequin Romance is a political statement because it sort of says what the author thinks women should be like in a certain way. But I think that there is an erasure of that presence, and there is a ridicule in it within the contemporary culture that makes it difficult to be overtly political and be a writer here, but as though the urgency wasn't the same. But I don't know. You know, it's an individual call. Yeah.
I was lucky to meet Wole Soyinka once.
Wow.
He was a very, very gracious man. He was here visiting the campus, and this was a number of years ago. And it was the time when he had been sentenced to death in absentia.
Right.
And I think he was the only guest I can think of we've had on the show that came with bodyguards.
Right.
which at the time was certainly no laughing matter, even
right.
though I don't know whether the arm of Nigerian government have reached far enough to the United States.
It certainly did.
But I'm sure it could have, so he would
yeah.
have had reason to
yeah.
to be concerned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly was. And, you know, he's it's funny because his life in many ways charts the, and it's very unusual to be able to say this is a writer whose life as a writer and as a political activist mirrors the entire growth of the country, because he sort of began to come into his own as a writer at the independence. And so from 1960 on, he's been the one consistent voice of conscience the whole country's had, and has become a huge symbol. And yet as a human being, he's sort of the most gracious, funny, really funny people. I mean, you know, this is a man who had a death threat, and it was real and it was dangerous, and there were certain attacks on him here by the Nigerian government, at the time Abacha's government. But you'd meet him and he would tell you these, you know, like funny stories about his optician, and I mean, he is such an amazing, inspiring figure, and one person who, for me, continues to remain at least an example of what I was talking about earlier, about people who are curators of our humanity, like Dennis Brutus from South Africa, or Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Soyinka. You know, there are all these remarkable individuals, and he carries it well. I mean, I don't think I could I could have that kind of weight on me. It's too much, yeah.
Well, we're certainly open to other questions from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just because of the earlier comment that you made about race and about
right.
the being an artificial concept, and the subject matter of Virgin of Flames,
right.
now I move to ask sort of the same question about what you think about gender.
Well, this is the other thing. I mean, it's one of, you know, gender is a freaky thing. We're so invested in these sort of fixed polarities and heterosexual and homosexual. And, you know, I think really, the truth be told, that those are the extreme aberrations, and that people, even if it's not expressed in a sexual manner, people are much more fluid in their gender along the line between the two poles. I mean, which is why there's all this talk about homoeroticism around football. It's sort of as if the ways in which men can demonstrate affection, because of, you know, tenderness and affection are very closely tied to notions of gender. And so it's sort of, I'm obsessed in many ways in all of my writing with masculinity and how it's constantly built around violence, and how men and in between each, men certainly have developed over time, for whatever reasons, the vocabulary for tenderness between men and women. But the vocabulary for tenderness between two men is that doesn't in some way get stereotyped and hijacked into sort of the Brokeback Mountain jokes and that kind of thing. What it's really, because masculine friendship is an incredible thing and sustains for years and years without even the same physical locations or attention that women's relationships seem to sort of play out in. And so there isn't any of that stuff. So I think gender is fluid. I think race, I think all these things are very fluid in all my books. Elvis dresses up, wears makeup. Mm. There are these moments when he has that difficulty. In this book, too, there's certainly a fluidity between the notion of women as, you know, how women have, the alternative to, you know, the way women are stereotyped as like the Martha Stewart hardness is to create this Earth Mother. But, you know, there's a whole range of women in between. And, you know, the reason why Gorgons are frightening is not because of their goriness, but because of the power that they inhabit. And I think that we're afraid of that kind of power. So all of my work, and certainly with the Virgin of Flames, it's also the ways in which the religious identity begins to tie into gender identities. And it's difficult to be a straight black African man writing about this stuff, because people somehow can't accept that conceptually your mind can be this fluid if you don't occupy those positions. So it's always fascinating to me, this conflation between the author's imagination and the author's life, which is sort of so, in many ways, so American, I think. Mm-hmm. I think I love fluidity.
Well, I think what you say there is true, at least that, and I'm certain that it is something writers have to struggle with
right.
because of that, and because so many readers have this automatic assumption right. that you read something and they really want to say to you, no, this is really you, right?
Right.
This is really about you. And I suppose in a sense,
it is.
Of course
right.
it is. It cannot not be. And
right.
yet you have to say, well, this is not autobiography.
Right.
Sure, it's informed by my experience
right.
that it would have to be. But no, this
right.
this character here,
right.
this is not me. This is not my
right.
life.
Right. And also that, I mean, it's everything we write is autobiographical, only in that, I suppose, it's your interface with the world. It's where you as an individual connect with the world and how you come to be and things you think about and how you come to those opinions. But the only difference, of course, is you get to write them down and people get to read them. And so that they're, you know... And also because people have all these different agendas too, like, you know, the little power pockets. And so certain people for furthering certain different rights want you to occupy certain different boxes. And it sort of goes against the whole notion, again, of the fluidity that you're dealing with. But also, I mean, as a writer, I write poetry, fiction. I'm an academic, so born academic papers and book reviews, so that they're even within the art form I make, there's that fluidity too. And I think it's really just a mental space that I occupy. But it's also difficult. It's easier as Chris is the writer than Chris in the world, because, you know, like, I'm liberal on say things like women's rights to choose, but I'm not liberal on gun control. So even my fluidity as a person is as complicated as anyone else's. So the imagined space it becomes a metaphorical ideal to explore that. But, you know, as Chris the person, I'm as boxed in as anyone else. As Chris the writer, then I can be really free. So I think there's that too.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we're moving into about our last 15 minutes, and I do again want to introduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in last little bit. We're talking with Nigerian-born writer Chris Abani. He is a novelist and poet. Right now he's teaching here in the United States. He teaches at the University of California at Riverside and also in the MFA program at Antioch University. That's in Los Angeles. He has won a number of awards for his work, including the Penn USA Freedom to Write Award, the Lannan History Fellowship, a California Book Award, and also the Penn Hemingway Book Prize in 2005. He's authored three novels, Graceland, Master of the Board, and one yet to be published, Virgin of Flames, and also a number of collections of poetry. And he'll be giving a reading from his work. He's here visiting and also the novella, Becoming Abigail, which is actually the most recent in print, which just came out this year. He'll be giving a reading as part of the CAR Visiting Authors Reading Series. This is sponsored by the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program. This afternoon, 4:30, in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore on Wright Street in Champaign on the campus. And questions, too, are welcome. People want to call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have had the opportunity, I think maybe, a lot of the people who have been brought here by the English Department the past few years to talk with some poets. And I'm sure that in at least some of those conversations, one of the things we talked about was the audience for poetry and right. the fact that it's small. And in this same interview that I mentioned, you said something that actually I thought that was kind of interesting. You seem to sort of take issue with that idea and argue that, in fact, while the audience for poetry may be small, it may indeed be now bigger
right.
than it's ever been before.
Yeah, I think that we live in apocalyptic times, which is sort of that everyone is always pronouncing the death of something, you know, death of book. It's sort of, you know, we're in a moment where we're struggling with a new way of being, sort of the way technology is so rapidly developed, even in the last 6 years, that I think that there are all these death knells for all these things, and poets complain all the time, or critics of poetry, the poetry is dead, no one's reading poetry now. When Frost was publishing, Frost's print run was like 700 books. And there was like maybe, 10 other poets at the time? Now, an average print run, even for an unknown poet, is 1,000 books. It's usually 3,000 books. Something like, 6,000 titles a year of poetry are being published and being sold. I think that maybe poetry isn't being read, but poetry is certainly being bought. excuse me. And so I don't like to get into these sort of what I call moral panics where everyone sort of rushes in, and poetry is alive and in all sorts of different forms. I mean, we have Deaf Poetry Jam, which is sort of a different kind of poetry, more performance aspect, and cable television, like a whole show. There are people who make a living now as a poet. You know, Wallace Stevens is an insurance executive. So I really, and then, you know, I think it's a great time to be a writer. It's really, I mean, some of us are luckier than some that we also get to teach, which is another big bonus, because, I mean, to teach writing is to talk about books with smart young people. What better job could you have? And then to be a writer. But I don't agree that poetry is dead. I think it's at a great place now.
Yeah, I do think something else, and I know I've also had the opportunity to talk a little bit about it with, again, some writers who have been here, and particularly this is with writers who also teach.
Right.
To ask about that and how it is you go about that, and right, and particularly how you walk this line between, you know, the tendency to want to rewrite someone's work like you would write it, and yes, to try to help them write it and do the best that they could, but keep it their,
yeah,
their work.
Well, I mean, I'm of the school. I don't really believe you can teach a person how to write. Mm-hmm. I think people write themselves into writing. Part of what a teacher's job is actually to teach people to be more nuanced in their readings, because I think there are a lot of us who are drawn to writing, but we don't really want to write. We want to be writers. I think they're two separate things. But what I teach, I've had to come up with terms for it, and I think right now what I teach is conceptual possibilities within the making of literature. So I teach poetry workshops using quantum physics and computer programming. I teach fiction using architecture, psychogeography, sort of the spaces of science, because I'm trying to work. I think what's sorely missing is not, there's enough how-to stuff. Mm-hmm. What's missing is sort of a conceptual philosophical relationship of a writer to what the writer's struggle is, and then how that can emerge is entirely up to the writer, which is a way to guard against teaching people to write like you.
So how do you teach poetry using quantum physics?
Well, I mean, essentially it's sort of beginning to think of things. One of the ways is to get away from the sort of pseudo-mystical ideas surrounding poetry. And sadly, and what's really interesting is when you take it into science, it becomes even more pseudo-mystical. But it's the idea that poems occupy space. They're actual physical objects. They're simulacrum. And so they can become machines almost. They are automaton that when someone else reads, perform in a certain kind of way. So it's almost like bits of computer code flying around the universe. And what the poet wants to do is to create enough of a complex code that it can produce multiple readings and multiple ways of being in the world, so that while everything converges on one particular point, which is the poem on the page, that's the first part. The more important part is the simultaneous explosions into the world. So Heisenberg becomes a wonderful way, the uncertainty principle becomes a wonderful way of playing around with those conceptual ideas. And also that we're writing in English, but American English, I would say, which as I've come here to learn, is a completely different form from England's English and certainly Nigerian English, but that we think we know the language when we don't. And so learning how computer programs or computer languages are kind of developed, the logical underpinnings, the philosophical ideas behind them, the relationships between sense and syntax, and become ways in which safer arenas to explore language without the defense mechanism that immediately triggers when you start to talk about the language that we speak with every day. So they're just little ways in which I try to sort of short-circuit their traditional ways of thinking, because I really think that that's really what it's about.
Given that you now live in the United States, have been in the United States for, right, a while, immersed in American popular culture, right, listening to English as it's spoken here in the United, right, States, how has that changed your writing?
I think it certainly made it more fluid, because one of the things I will say, it's like I was in Germany recently. We were talking about sort of the Germans were saying there's no more German nationalism. It's because of the fear of sort of the guilt of the Nazi era, which again is not indicative. But there's a large Turkish population, and there are no Turkish words in German. It's a very pure language. Mm-hmm. So the nationalism exists within the language. And what's curious about America is for all, that's why I sort of laugh about these notions of race and stuff, because for all its notions of purities and the sort of the extremes of white power, but also the notions in which global capital tries to play race, it's a language that every culture that comes in here, after a while, those words begin to be absorbed into American English. And then not only they absorb, but then every contemporary moment massages those things. And so, you know, you think of say, a pirate's booty suddenly becoming sort of slang for backsides, and then someone like certain singers turn it into bootylicious. And so the language is such an alive place, and sort of is the one area of resistance to power positions. And so for me, it's made my writing so much more fluid, because the language, when I use more and more American English, it's already conditioned to resist. So it's more fluid, and I love it. I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, you think Americans, they may not think about it, but are more playful and more inventive in their approach to the way that they speak than some other people?
Certainly so, and also I think that Americans are far more philosophical than they give themselves credit for. Sort of, I teach, and sort of the face of 20th century and certainly still 21st century American philosophy is dominated by French philosophers, European philosophers. And yet I think that we have enough of a philosophical way of being here, even within the context of language alone, that hasn't been explored, that allows people like Skip Gates to come out with amazing ideas around things like the signifying monkey and all these sort of ideas, and that sort of never get explored, because Americans, I think the big problem is, like with all adolescents, there's this rejection of Europe as sort of the parent, but also the same teenage obsession with the parent as its identity. So it's a curious place to be at the same time. Yeah.
Do you, as an African,
right,
do you occupy a different space here, you think, in America and in American culture than do African Americans?
Completely. You know, I was actually having this conversation today. Being an African is actually a very privileged position in this culture, because there is no guilt associated with me. There is no issues around slavery or former slaves and reparations. There is none of the negotiations to deal with around this stuff. And it's also a privileged position, because I've never lived this experience. And I've never, in many ways, lived the racist experience until as an adult you come to confront it. So that I'm positioned I'm far more flexible within the system, and I work better for hiring. There's no history to deal with, and it's sort of come into this place and sort of realizing how privileged I am and how different it is to occupy the same racial category, but to occupy a different social and mental space. I think there's a whole conversation that still has to be had around that. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I think, more interestingly, between Africans and African Americans, because I think Africans take so much for granted when you arrive here, and there's been real no attempts to. But I think there's a whole philosophical conversation here that is, we could go on for like hours, because I did this morning with with Professor Fedi about this. But I think it's a unique and interesting place to be, but a very privileged one, one that I kind of own and have to own.
Yeah. And given that, I guess we're sort of coming back to the idea of teaching. Given that you, I would think then for some of your students, you would be kind of an exotic in a sense. In the sense that anyone that they would get to work with who had not been born and grown up in the United States, right, would be an exotic. What do they looking for from you?
Well, you know, the thing is, again, because of my teaching style, my background and my education, it's not so much an exotic situation. But I think what happens is they forget that I'm black, because I don't sound like an African American. And it's a realization in class to realize at that moment that really race in America has more to do with social position than it has to do with biological race, which is sort of why I was talking about that earlier. Because of the accent, they forget. And after a while, you simply become you know, you become Chris. So that in many ways, I'm allowed to be an individual in this culture much more than an African American might be. But you know, the kids I work with are great. And after a while, you know, all they can talk about is how difficult my classes are. So.
You're making their life hell, just like all their other teachers. Maybe we can real quick get in a caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. You may have talked about this before, but I'm really interested in what you were talking about, the connections between African-Americans and Africans. But I wanted to talk about literature in particular mm-hmm. and about some of those similar problems that faced early generations of black writers, say, for example, with English language, and how mm-hmm. if you're going to represent the black experience in America or Africa, you have to write in a language that black people speak. I mean, it's English, but it's black English, if you can. There's also the problem with responding back to Western representations of black people, whether you're African or African-American. So I think on the intellectual level and as far as literature is concerned, there are a lot more parallels than what you were just talking about in terms mm-hmm. of the day-to-day living experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can give you about a minute to respond to this excellent question.
I think that first of all, the difficulty as for any writer is to get into trying to deal with stereotypical representations. I think that we're certainly in the face of contemporary African literature, we're engaged in a more postmodern, I think, moment where we are saying we're not writing in response to your stereotypes. We're going to have our conversation over here. If you want to join us, come and join us, which I think is a far more valid way, because you can never, I think that you can never write your way out of those sort of conundrums. And also, that I was talking about this earlier, sort of the ideas in which what we sometimes think about as black English is more an issue of class than it is an issue of race. And the moment you engage in the writing process, you already remove yourself from a certain class situation. And so it's a very complex and what a potentially fascinating area of study. But I do know that there would be no African literature without African-American literature and vice versa. And I think that's also an area that really needs to be talked about, how James Baldwin has sort of become in many ways the dominant muse for a lot of African writers and vice versa, sort of particularly Yoruba mythology becoming sort of the dominant underlying mythology for African American writing. So it's you know, there's we only have like two more seconds, but you know, if you come to the reading tonight, we can talk about that.
And if you would like to hear more from our guest Chris Abani, he'll be giving a reading. This is part of the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series, sponsored by the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program, 4:30 this afternoon in the Authors Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Support for the show today comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series at 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, April 4th, Room 100 of Noyes Lab of Chemistry, 505 South Matthews. The Geological Survey presenting a public seminar titled Energy in the 21st Century. The markets are here, but the resources are there. Speakers are Drs. Robert Skinner, former director of the Policy Office of